Welcome to another episode of Coffee Chats with Researchers. I am your hostess, Katie Butner, and I am coming to you today with my conversation with Toby Shulruff, who is a practitioner and who talks to me and explains interpersonal threat models, which I had no idea what that term referred to prior to this conversation. And I am excited for you to listen to it. We get into a lot of things around technology and cybersecurity and how that relates to understanding violence and violence prevention. So it's an excellent conversation. I learned so much and I hope you do as well. So thank you for your time and your flexibility, and I'm happy to meet you. So can you tell me a little about who you are and your work and just what in the field of violence against women, where your focus lies?
Sure. So I started in this work, specifically in sexual assault work, in the late 90s as I came out of undergraduate. And my undergraduate studies were focused on social change movements and women's movements. And so but from a very interdisciplinary school. So I was one of the few people who actually applied what I learned, I guess, when I got out into the workforce. And I began working with the Washington Coalition of Sexual Assault Programs, which is in Olympia, Washington. And I coordinated trainings and conferences. And so I developed a really early love of hearing sort of the best and the brightest of what was happening in the field and translating that high level thinking into very practical steps for advocates on the ground. So one of the things that we did in those early years was to start a research and advocacy digest where we would try and take everything from the National Crime Victimization Survey to smaller studies and put those into bite-sized chunks that advocates could use in their awareness campaigns and their community education and their grant proposals, whatever that was, to help them guide their work. And we did a lot of really interesting cross-disciplinary work too as well with, for example, sex offender treatment providers. So how did that research have an impact on how advocates would support survivors? How could survivors benefit from accurate information about sex offenders and risks, for example? And then in 2003, I began working at the intersection of technology with violence against women, working with Cindy Southworth for the project that I work for now. So I work at the Safety Net Project in the National Network to End Domestic Violence. And we look at domestic violence, sexual assault, and stalking primarily, and all sorts of technology, from location-based technology to social media, to big data, to smartphones, to the Internet of Things, and look for both impacts in terms of risks and negative impacts, as well as benefits and strategic use of those technologies. So that leads to one of the biggest areas that I've been working on for the past 2.5-3 years. So prior to the pandemic, we developed a toolkit around using technology to communicate with survivors while keeping safety and privacy in mind and really trying to increase access. So we had a few dozen places around the country that were interested in that prior to the pandemic. But as you can imagine, in the middle of March of last year, it was a deluge of requests of which video platform should we use and how can we add web chat or text to our helpline? How do we do work from our homes rather than from the office with confidentiality in mind? And so by June of last year, so just shy of a year ago, we held a webinar on online communication skills. And when we asked folks who registered for that about whether they had been providing those kinds of services, video, chat, or text prior to the pandemic, or if they had just started, we had over 500 programs saying that they had just started in the past couple of months. And so we also did a needs assessment in December and January where we followed up to sort of say, okay, how much are you actually using those things? So you may have implemented them, but... And what we found is that most people were relying on traditional phone calls and, you know, safe physical meetings with, you know, public health precautions and things like that. But that people were still also using those tools like web chat and text, particularly for support groups. So across sort of that range from first-time contacts to ongoing advocacy to longer-term, you know, connection between survivors. I also have had the great pleasure of going back to graduate school after all of these years as a practitioner, and I am studying public interest technology. So how technology can be in service of people and planet at the Arizona State University. And so in that, I am able to really dig into the cybersecurity and design and development side of technology to look at implications around this work as well.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I'd want to start with, and it's going to take us back a little, but is you mentioned kind of really that initial dissemination work or like community connection work, where what you're saying was creating these bite-sized pieces of information that organizations could use to apply for future funding or how to articulate their work. Can you speak a bit to why you, like, what makes that so valuable and important, and how you see that maybe continuing to be a need, if at all?
Sure. So, I mean, I think this cuts across disciplines, but to speak specifically to our work, I'm a bit of a geek. I love research. I love reading academic papers. Most people don't, or even if they do, they don't have time to, particularly for frontline advocates and others who are working with survivors. It's a high stress job. They're coping sometimes with vicarious trauma. They have not enough funding for the demand for their services. They just don't have time to dig through. And yet, the questions that researchers ask and the results that they find are crucial to shaping our work. It's really this very interesting sort of balance in our work between really being present with each human being, each survivor who has come to ask for help, and seeing them as a unique person with their own unique constellation of goals and needs and fears and experiences. And then also finding what's universal, right? We know that when a single story drives policy, for example, the policy is not as strong as it could be. And at the same time, we don't want to so generalize that we end up losing sight of the unique intersections which can exacerbate somebody's vulnerability to violence, someone's inability to reach support or help or justice for that experience, right? So we have to be able to hold both things. And I feel like research is a way to do that, to help an individual frontline advocate to be present with the person they're with, and then also when they're talking with their city council or their county or their law enforcement agency or their funder, to say, this is true, and also we know that this is true, so that we get better policy, we get better funding priorities, and so that there's support for the reality that frontline workers are seeing on the ground, and also so we don't lose sight of, well, but that's just the people who come to the door, right? Like perhaps a local program doesn't see so many survivors with disabilities or doesn't serve as many Indigenous women. And so having research is a great way to help drive them to build greater community connections, to form partnerships with organizations in those communities, to really open up their services to the people who need them most.
And so being someone who is a practitioner and is now moving into education again, right? Like, and also is someone who does enjoy that analytical kind of the research space. Can you paint a picture of how all of those years or how all of your experience in clinical work has really shaped your view of research and maybe what you see as a need that that field can also continue to look at?
As much as I enjoy reading academic papers, to be honest, I find it frustrating I understand why we say it, right? Because there is always something else to learn, and we never will reach a point where we have definitive knowledge in something. But it is frustrating to read things like, you know, the distinctions or the categories around violence against women or interpersonal violence are poorly defined, or we really don't have data to support this, or we don't really have a clear picture of what victimization looks like. And I think that's, again, that tension, right? Because you ask anyone who's working with survivors, they're like, I can tell you what victimization looks like. Now, is that in, again, that way that can be generalizable to be applicable? And that's where the tension is. So I understand the caveats and I understand the limitations and that we need to put those in an academic way in there. But I guess I want us to go deeper. I want us to go, You know, I've just recently been reading back to papers that are 10 years old or older, and we're saying the same thing, right? And so at some point, I want to say, okay, there's a limit to how useful having the data is. I think as feminists, as researchers, we want to say, if we only have good data, they'll believe us. And they'll finally take this seriously, and we'll finally be able to change society. And I'm just not convinced that that's true. Unfortunately, it is the unique and sometimes not generalizable story that does motivate people to do something. And then, as I said before, that results in policy that is not ideal, right? So we have to maybe explore other ways of telling the story of what we do know in a compelling way. And in addition, I think that in large part, perhaps because in the US context and somewhat internationally, the Violence Against Women Act, which first passed in 1994, led us to a strong alignment with criminal justice system options as being the solution to domestic violence, sexual assault and stalking and human trafficking, et cetera, et cetera. And we know that those options fall short in a number of ways. We know that, you know, only a small portion of survivors ever choose to even report what happens to them. And then that funnel just gets smaller and smaller when it gets to actual convictions of offenders. We also know that for whole communities who have a historic distrust or have experienced harms through the criminal justice system, they're not going to turn to that option. And for all of those reasons, you know, programs like ours at Safety Net exist to help survivors and advocates to have solutions, which include, you know, how to get what's needed to go through the criminal justice system or the civil legal system. But in addition, what are those do-it-yourself strategies? And to have accurate information for survivors and advocates to be able to understand how technology works and to then be able to find safety and privacy options within that. But then also to do work, again, as we do at the Safety Net Project, but there's always more to be done there, working with technology companies, working with cybersecurity firms and specialists to say the very design of these technologies themselves, and from design, from development, to how it's marketed, to what the response is when something goes wrong, none of those things are built for survivors of domestic violence, sexual assault, or stalking, right? They're built for national security concerns. They're built for corporate, you know, intellectual property concerns. They're built to stop, you know, the theft of credit card numbers and financial fraud. And those are usually perpetrated by someone who isn't in the house of and able to pick up the cell phone, a survivor, right? And so it's shifting that as well. It's one thing for us to be able to sort of in this ad hoc way become sort of quasi cybersecurity specialists, where we're able to say, here's where your setting is, or here's, you know, how you can make your password stronger. But a strong password doesn't help if someone coerces or forces you to share that password. It doesn't matter how strong it is, or if they know how to get into your password manager to find all of your passwords. It's just not an effective strategy at all. So how do we talk about designing those things differently, designing technology so it's not as easily misused, designing cybersecurity responses so that they are usable and practical and take into account the complexity of human relationships rather than regarding that as an inconvenience?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that you talked about is the telling the story and the connection with policy. And I think that that's such a critical part of just how we envision research and that and the body of work moving forward, because that connection between the output that research can produce, but then the impact when trying to connect it, it just like isn't always there. And like what you're saying about envisioning how we tell a story, I'm wondering if you can talk a bit about how you've seen that change with your work, especially in technology, and the work to offer or maybe consider the kind of the public interest element of how has that been for you working with something that is more survivor-centric about kind of leveraging technology in a way that does offer more platforms and more opportunities to tell a better story, to engage more effectively.
Yeah, sure. There's a few directions with that. One trend that I think is really useful at this intersection of technology and interpersonal violence is really reclaiming and either claiming or reclaiming a broad array of research tools, right? Like, it's super helpful to have national samples and prevalence, and like that is needed, right? We need sort of a basis, but we also can look at, you know, qualitative research, which has long been used, you know, in the literature in this area around technology and interpersonal violence with really small sample sizes. We, you know, as tends to be the case for qualitative research, right? But looking at tools like participatory action research, right? So I guess it's harmonizing research with the impulse and the initial vision of, you know, second wave feminism as it came to apply to this work of domestic violence and sexual assault. And I don't mean in all the ways that are complicated and not useful, like, you know, dominant voices of white women and things like that, but more to reclaim those roots of, like, it was people who had experience as survivors who drove the movement to begin with. And I think that we tend to see survivors now as service recipients or clients rather than as empowered, active participants. And that's where I think reclaiming participatory action research and similar strategies can be really beneficial, because as we were just talking about, if the majority of survivors aren't going into the criminal justice system and the majority of survivors are also not turning to domestic violence programs or rape crisis centers, then they're doing it themselves. And we know that survivors have strengths and are resilient and are creative, but we don't explore that as much. And so that's really been my curiosity in digging through the research recently. And what took me back to this research from, you know, 10 plus years ago is to say, in what ways were we already asking back then about the strategies, protective strategies that survivors were using? And how can we do more of that to build out our own toolkit, to get a sense of what's working, but also to be able to take that to policymakers, to take that to companies, to take that to cybersecurity folks and say, this is what survivors still need. These are the barriers they're encountering to being able to do it themselves, you know, or to have help from advocates or law enforcement or whomever. So I think that's important. And so I think that very thread of using qualitative research, participatory action research, things like that, is in and of itself weaving the stories of survivors into the story that we're telling in research, right? And it leads very clearly, I think, to compelling calls. When professional advocates can go to policymakers and say, survivors tell us they need this, I think that's really helpful. When we can go to companies and say, we have spoken with survivors who say, it's really difficult to follow your reporting flow. It would be easier to shift it around this way or to add an entirely different option. That's just far more compelling. And it's also less mediated, right? We're not deciding what's valuable or not valuable about what survivors have said, but carrying their voices forward in a way that still respects their autonomy and privacy, right? Because we know that when survivors speak out online, there can be terrible repercussions in terms of trolls and doxing and all these online harms that they experience. Even the researchers who are doing that research are targeted by those things sometimes. So how do we balance that and really give people choice and agency and control over their own stories?
Absolutely. So many really great things. One of which I want to, though, say, do you have it helps to make it more tangible, but like, when talking about using or kind of cycling back to more engaged participatory action research, do you have an example or like an idea of something that you've seen work in that way?
Sure. Just this year, Julia Slipska with the Oxford Internet Institute did a project along with other researchers called Reconfigure that used participatory action research to explore cybersecurity shortcomings and strengths. And that is just a really interesting approach that is specifically about this nexus that we're talking about, but then also draws in, you know, sort of a less used research approach in this particular field. Yeah.
Do you have what's the vision for where that work will kind of end up, or like where it will take that project, I guess, if you know?
Sure. I mean, if you have unlimited interviews, you might also reach out to Julia and talk with her. She has a lot of passion and drive towards the direction she's going in. But she's very focused on shifting cybersecurity practices to include intimate partner and interpersonal threat models in a way that they haven't before. And then I personally like take that a little further to say, what does that mean in terms of how survivors and advocates can apply those things as well? I mean, I've really started since being in dialogue with her and others who are doing similar work to think of those strategies really as, like I said, ad hoc cybersecurity strategies, that we tend to think of cybersecurity as like, you know, the NSA or whatever, but instead to say, when we are countering online harms, that is cybersecurity. And particularly since the sort of establishment of cybersecurity hasn't taken into account our threat models, we are kind of making that up as we go along and cobbling it together from what's available to us. And I think there's a lot of fruitful ground there in terms of deeper dialogue between cybersecurity and people who are doing this work, both to improve the way that general cybersecurity is done to take into account those threat models, but then also to give greater skills and tools to frontline workers and to survivors.
Absolutely. So just as a point of clarification, can you explain what you mean by interpersonal threat models?
Sure, absolutely. So thinking about how someone who's experiencing domestic violence or sexual assault or stalking experiences technology, we are often told that we should change our passwords, that we should not enable two-factor authentication, that there are these strategies that are just sort of given out generally to like a consumer audience or to anyone who works in a business or workplace. And they don't take into account that the person who's harming me could just walk into the room and pick up my phone, and that we know work from like Periwinkle-Dorfler and others that most people are sharing their devices. They're sharing their device with their kids. They're sharing their device with their partner. It is in some ways, and I think particularly so when you get into younger generations, it's considered a sign of trust in a relationship, whether a friendship or a more intimate romantic relationship, to share passwords, to share devices, right? That says, I have nothing to hide, right? And that is a tremendous vulnerability, right? So when you have the cybersecurity messages like, don't share your password, it's very judging. If you're like, well, this happened to me, like, well, we told you not to share your password, when really that's not realistic to how everyday people are living their lives in relationship with other people, A, whether they're experiencing abuse or not. But if they are, the typical things that are going to keep my credit card safe from a hacker who's overseas are not going to keep me safe in those scenarios. And we don't really have much else to offer. I mean, even if you look at our website, you see like create strong passwords, you know, because it is a valid strategy. It's just not going to help in most of the circumstances. So the intimate partner threat model is where someone has physical access to your devices or has enough personal knowledge of you to be able to bypass typical security precautions and advice to be able to get into accounts remotely as well. And then there's also that sort of coercive or threat scenario where no matter what steps you take, and particularly if you take those steps, it might escalate your risk of violence and of further coercion.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to cycle back a bit to when you discussed the criminal justice system and VAWA, I think that it kind of makes me think too, even of the cybersecurity, which you were just talking about, and kind of how we immediately think of it in this one way. And you would never really think of cybersecurity as it relates to personal violence, like as being intertwined, that those things are connected. And you, again, only think of the, you know, someone hacking government things as cybersecurity, right? But so what that with kind of combined what you mentioned about VAWA, and that we kind of created the standard of how to handle trafficking or partner violence or sexual assault, all of these things is in this criminal justice space. Can you speak a bit to why that proves or has presented some challenges and maybe what you see as a way forward to offer better or more maybe effective options that aren't just reliant on a criminal justice stance?
Sure. To me, one of the most compelling reasons that the model falls short is that we know that while anyone can experience these kinds of violence, that we know that some groups and some communities experience violence disproportionately, right? We know that people with disabilities experience sexual abuse, domestic abuse, violence from caregivers at a catastrophic rate. We know that Indigenous women particularly experience violence at horrendous rates. We know that lesbian, gay, bisexual, trans folks are experiencing violence, and that they are either not interested in participating in the criminal justice system for a whole variety of historical reasons, or when they do, they aren't treated respectfully, or they aren't listened to, or the cases don't move forward because they're not seen as quote unquote good victims, right? So that for me is the compelling piece, is that people who are from communities that are most experiencing these harms and experiencing the most barriers to safety and privacy and justice and healing are not able to access them. There's a whole lot of other reasons that I could give to you, but to me, that's the core. And when I think about models that stem from second wave feminism and approaches to domestic violence, particularly, there was a large emphasis on sort of like leave, you know, or that ending the relationship is the only option. And what we know, again, from survivors, like if we set aside our own feeling about what would be best, that many survivors don't want to leave. And if you think about folks from Indigenous communities who are living on land that they have been living on for tens of thousands of years, leaving is entirely different than what folks who live in a very mobile, highly mobile community where they have only lived in a place for a couple of years. You know, that's just different and it's not relevant, right? Or it shouldn't be the only option, or it shouldn't be a standard, just like you should have a strong password. And if you didn't, it's your own fault. It shouldn't be judged against survivors that they choose not to leave, right? Or that the assumption is that they need to leave and not the person who's violent, right? So all of these reasons. And so I think we need to take that from the real world, which has little to do with technology, and apply that to this intersection with technology as well. And to say that it is an unreachable and maybe unwantable and standard to say that we all have our own accounts and passwords and we never share anything with anybody. Maybe that's just not the way that technology should work. There were decisions that were made that have resulted in path dependencies where we make assumptions based on the military and early industrial application of these technologies, command and control, that that's the way that it should be. But that doesn't necessarily reflect community and caring and the complicated way that families interrelate, the complicated ways that we form friendships and bonds. So our technology is not built on what we know about what it is to be human. It is built on what worked for designing missile detection systems for World War II, right? And we need to bring it around to that if it's going to be sustainable for us, if we are going to be able to use technology in strategic ways that build our safety and our community and futures for ourselves versus being used by technology, which is what's happening now. Because the very models, like everybody is experiencing harms from technology, are how technology is extracting from us our data, is coercing us into purchasing things or clicking on things or becoming, you know, of a particular political persuasion. Like all of that is being, we are being manipulated using those technology tools, and it shouldn't be that way.
I mean, flip the table, right? Like I'm just, you're making me be like, well, I'm ready. It's what you're saying makes so much sense. And I think it is a beautiful summary of that, of the underpinnings of how technology, because I think especially given that when we think of human technology or human-centered technology, people think about social media. And so we see it as like, well, if you're saying that, like, no, technology is inherently connecting us. Without that critique of the underpinnings of what, like what you're saying, that our initial framing of the utilization of technology is rooted very much in what we needed around global security, strategic warfare, and industrialization. And so then applying the principles that helped us or were important to us around maintaining sort of the needs of that to now what we see here, there isn't flexibility or moldability to question, like you're saying, how do people actually form relationships and where does technology fit in with that? I think it's a good segue to then talk a bit about your work and your interests, which you've given a lot of insight to already. But what feels like that next step for you, especially going into a field, right? Formalizing that field for yourself in that education space. And yeah, and what do you see as that next step?
Sure. So I see that there are several directions where work is needed in this area. And it really goes from, you know, updating policies and regulation, both of technology and of the ways that we respond to technology facilitated abuse and violence, to improving cybersecurity practices to better take into account this human dimension, whether it's within interpersonal violence or more broadly just humanness, to shifting how technologists do their work. And that links to broader pieces around the technology field needing to become more diverse, both in terms of identity, but also in ways of being in the world and lived experience on the teams who are designing those things. So like, I want to see technology designed and sold better. I want to see cybersecurity done better. I want to see policy updated to reflect realities and really meet the needs of the greatest number of people. But even more than that, I believe that the tools of technology, which is really power in our society at the moment, need to be taken back into the hands of communities and particularly of survivors, given my niche on this. And I think that we have a tremendous potential to affect sort of the long term of all those other pieces of cybersecurity, of technology, design, of policy, by starting, for example, to integrate public interest technology, to integrate technology in service of society and people and planet, to STEM and STEAM programs, to coding camps, and that a lot of communities see those as ways for girls or for people of color to be able to get into the tech industry, which helps diversify the tech industry. But if you're just training people to come in and think the way that everybody in those industries already thinks, that's not a benefit to themselves or to their communities, right? So we need to really leverage that to say, what do you know? What problems do you see in your family? What problems do you see in your neighborhood? What problems do you see in your community broadly? And how can these tools that you are learning, these skills that you're learning, how can they apply to those problems rather than how can that get you a job, right? Doing something. Because we know that a lot of people enter the tech industry go in wanting to change the world for the better. And they get there and they become disillusioned, right? That's why we have so many tech worker movements right now saying, I didn't get into this to do this work. I didn't get into this to manipulate people or to throw elections or whatever that is, right? So how do we get in at those sort of like middle school and high school programs to bring in that sense of like, apply this to the problems, the questions, the goals that you have and that your community has. And then also to reflect that back and say, what have you learned from that? What is that expertise that you're bringing, right? It's a shifting of that power balance from, you know, I'm someone who needs this gift of technology to be able to accomplish something. The technology needs the gift of the people who are doing the work and it needs the gift of the experience of communities. So that's really where I'm most interested is how do we shift to community-led design? How do we take the greatest impulses of what's often referred to as co-design or participatory design or public engagement to have that power balance shifted without people having to become, you know, PhDs in computer science to do that or to get a venture capitalist to back them to be heard?
Right. Absolutely. When you think of that too, since survivorship is your niche area in there, where do you see that applying to the work you do with survivors?
Sure. So just reading this 2011 paper by Diamond et al., and actually the researcher had already been working as a volunteer in a domestic violence program. And so she did her research with women in the program. And so I think that is a really interesting approach. I mean, granted, it gets you a narrow slice of survivors, right? Because it's just people who have reached out for help from the sort of traditional institutions. So that needs to be broader. But I think that that's one approach, is to say, what are your strengths? What are your resiliencies? What is your creativity? How are you approaching these problems? What's working, what's not working? And that maybe the design of some of those toolkits could happen in that way. And that if researchers or cybersecurity folks or technologists are coming in to do that, that they're not parachuting in for a hackathon, or that they're saying, hey, we'll design a panic button app. I mean, I can't tell you how many panic button apps there are, right? Like, we had this great idea of how we can solve your problem. Just take this from us, like, you know, and be grateful for it. Instead, going in and saying, we haven't even defined what the problem is yet. And an amazing example of this is what Caravan Studios, which is a part of TechSoup, which is a nonprofit that supports other nonprofits in using technology. Caravan Studios has this amazing generate and design process that is a 2-day process or more, where they go in with the community and people define the problem for themselves and begin to come up with ideas of how to address that using technology and then prototype them. And then TechSoup and Caravan Studios takes that and applies technologists and all of this to like make it fancier and like, you know, build it up into something that can actually be used. But from the very question of what are we trying to solve, communities are involved. So things like what Caravan Studios are doing that directly with advocates and survivors in a long-term relationship, not just a parachute in. And then also, as I mentioned, that piece about building in this public interest technology into STEM or STEAM and coding, we know that survivors are everywhere, right? So whenever you have a program that involves middle schoolers and high school students, they will unfortunately have themselves experienced dating violence or sexual violence or stalking, or they will know someone who has. And so by doing that work and naming that there are harms that can happen from technology, you're helping to sort of equip people to help themselves, to help each other, and to also have that in mind as they go forward into building technology or doing cybersecurity or whatever else it is that they do with their lives.
I'm so interested in what you're talking about, just even personally. I think it's such a fascinating point about ensuring like the participation of the community of interest, like even in the question we're saying we're asking, and just the impact that that could have in terms of sustainability. And I mean, of course, and in overall impact. But one of the things that I think we come back to often is like, how do we stop solving the same problem over and over again? And I know we're never really solving it, but that kind of thing of there's often moments where it feels incredibly repetitive to keep trying to put Band-Aids on things. And oftentimes what we know is because communities don't feel connected to it. And there's not long-term buy-in. So that's a fascinating model. I want to wrap up with the question that I like asking, but like if you had just an unlimited pot of money, what would you like to see happen? So thinking from like in the field, specifically in kind of the violence against women field, what would you want to put that money toward and make happen?
Sure. So I have two answers. So I would like for someone to do this research. This is not the research that is like the beating of my heart. I mean, I want the answers, not to be the one doing it. That is to ask what is working for survivors and what's needed. I really want to know more about that. And I'll give you just one really crystal clear example of that. Quick escape exit buttons on all of our websites. And we want to know, we've been just in the past year, strides in how those are designed. We have no idea whether they are actually useful to people, whether people even notice them, whether in fact they are effective. Do they keep people safe? We just don't know. And that's true. If that's true of an exit button on a website, it's true of so much else that we're doing in terms of this field. So there's just a whole lifetime of questions for dozens of research groups.
It makes me think of the panic button you mentioned, right? Like, let me just give you more panic button apps that you can have, whether or not you need them.
We think it's useful, but we don't actually know that. Yeah. So there's that. Then the other, so the piece that I am really driven to do is that I want to see bridges built between cybersecurity, technologists, technology designers, advocates, and the degree to which they can participate sort of safely and autonomously, survivors and communities, to really start shaping these questions and reshaping how we build technology and how we do this work. And I am fascinated to do that on a small scale level, but I'm really most interested in developing the tools by which that can be replicated in many places. So that's, you know, building toolkits for technologists to understand how to engage with communities from that level of problem definition, using design thinking or whatever other buzzwords they want to use to get to the place where their technology better reflects these threat models that we're aware of, but also reflects what would be in that sort of primary prevention way, like nurturing of community and healthy positive behavior. Because we know how we design technology can shift the degree to which some people are going to use or misuse technology. So there's that. And likewise for cybersecurity. But then I also want advocates and survivors to feel like they have the tools that they need to be able to address these problems. So I want to build bridges. I want advocates and survivors to be able to learn from cybersecurity folks. I want technologists to learn from advocates and survivors and communities. I want space for those fruitful dialogues. And I feel like people really are not sure how to go about that. And so my greatest interest is in creating frameworks and toolkits for that to happen.
That's awesome. Well, I'm very excited to be able to see, because it sounds like sometimes when I ask that question, it's very wonderful, but lofty responses that are next to impossible to have happen. And while I think that your answers are certainly ambitious, they don't feel as impossible, or to the, like what you're saying, it sounds like you're kind of already working on the creating those frameworks towards that second part of your answer as well. So I'm excited to see how that develops, and good luck grad school and just continuing education ever is like always, it's the added thing to the work you're already doing, right? So it's a lot of stuff to take on, but good luck.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Coffee Chats with Researchers. You can always find more of these coffee chats on our website, which is vawconsortium.rutgers.edu. And of course, you can always reach out to us via social media or via email. We are always happy to hear from you with your thoughts, your questions, your feedback, or just generally to give us a hello. As always, stay curious, ask questions, drink coffee, and we will see you for our next episode of Coffee Chats with Researchers.